from the Carter Subaru Studios, this is the G and Ursula Show with G. Scott and Ursula Voitine.
Never too much.
Oh, that's it. That's a jam. Happy Fresh Friday here on the G and Ursula Show. Good morning, Ursula.
Good morning, G. It is a Fresh Friday. It is April 26th. And as always, we have a very full show for you. But it is going to be a Fresh Friday type of show. So we'll make sure that we have a lot of fun. Burien's mayor and the King County sheriff, though, right now are locked in a legal battle over how to deal with homeless encampments. We've reached out to both sides. We're going to have one guest coming on at 9:30 this morning. Burien's mayor is going to be joining us.
Okay.
So we want to stay tuned for that interview. Of course, we cannot do this show without you. Our Muckleshoot Casino Resort text line is 888-973-5476, 888-973-CHIRO.
Let's get to it. Top stories of the day brought to you by Way, Scar, 40, Susu, and Auburn.
Four women who work in the Seattle Police Department have now filed a $5 million claim accusing the police chief and other department leaders of sexual discrimination and harassment. In one case, the claim says the police chief seemed to, quote, groom an officer named Valerie Carson. The Seattle Times reports after she joined the public affairs unit, Carson alleges that Chief Diaz offered to replace the windows at her home and made comments about her attire that made her feel uncomfortable. Lieutenant John O'Neill, who leads the public affairs unit, is also named in this claim. One plaintiff claims that he touched her inappropriately during a meeting in 2021 and suggested she move in with him. Another claims that he told her he was really good at sex. When the women complained to the HR manager, they say that manager, Rebecca McKechnie, would blame the victims instead of stopping the abusive behavior. She is also named in this claim. And according to the complaint, another officer, Lauren Truscott, reviewed the transcripts of interviews from several of the women making accusations and said that she realized that Lieutenant O'Neill was displaying a pattern of predatory, abusive, and harassing behavior. She filed a complaint against him, and then she says he then turned around and filed several complaints against her. Through their attorney, these plaintiffs say that as the department is actively trying to recruit women to work for SPD, the department is actively punishing women for refusing to submit to their male supervisors' bullying and harassing behavior. In a statement, SPD says, this is a quote, "While individual grievances may drive headlines, the department is confident that the record in its fullness will prove them unsupported."
Well, first of all, the alleged things that have happened reading in this article out of the Seattle Times was, to me, disturbing. And they were disturbing because there were some things that really stood out to me. One, we obviously see a culture where a supervisor is going to dinner with a subordinate. That right there to me is a red flag. Right. When that's happening right there, you know, if you are a supervisor, I'm not saying that work culture or anything that you can't have a situation where there is going out. But when you have that situation where a supervisor is going to dinner with a subordinate, or it also in there, it was talking about a trip to Las Vegas in which one of the she thought that there was just going to be folks with their partners. She found out it was folks with their partners. But no, it ended up being where the two of them were the only single ones. And then they went out to dinner and found up they were watching the game together. So you know what I did, Ursula, this morning? I was curious. On the way this morning, I decided to call my cousin. My cousin is a sergeant with the Chicago Police Department. She's been on the force now for almost 20 years. And just so happened, she had one of her coworkers with her. They're at a training right now because of the DNC. The Democratic National Convention is going to happen in August. So they're in preparation and training for that. And her coworker has been an officer. She's a lieutenant, and she's been an officer for 29 years. And so what I asked them was this. I said, hey, is the culture bad within law enforcement for female law enforcement? And the exact quote was, "I'm not going to say that it's bad. I'm just going to say that it's hard, because I think that where somebody else might have an opinion, they might say it's bad or they might say this." So she said, collectively, I'll say it's hard. I've been here 29 years. Has it gotten better? Yes. And what's gotten better is the ability to be able to report all of the different avenues. Because when she got there previous to and back in 1995, that wasn't that easy. One of the things that was interesting, and matter of fact, if you are a law enforcement right now, you'll know that I really did have a conversation. They said this, Ursula. One of the things that sometimes we women and law enforcement are afraid of sometimes, and we choose not to report, we're afraid to have a brick attached to us. Now, that term that I just used, if you're in law enforcement, you know that I really had a conversation with them. And when they say that, the brick means is that brick is put on you, like that means you can't move. Paperwork kind of trails you, and so it's harder for you, and departments are like, oh, there's that person. So sometimes you're afraid to that. Also, sometimes when people say things like, oh, you only got that promotion because, and they're in that report in the Seattle Times, it actually talks about one of the officers having a rumor of having sex, and she approached the supervisor about that rumor, and the quote was, according to the article, well, that would be a feather in my cap.
Yes. So, and that was allegedly made by Lieutenant John O'Neill.
So here's what I'm trying to say, Ursula. I'm saying this. This is going to be something, it's going to be a legal battle. It's going to be something that's going to happen in court. I'm going to say that I truly believe in this situation, it's no different than other work cultures across the country. Whether it is law enforcement, whether it's this or is that, I think a lot of work cultures need to clean it up because for so long it was so bad. And now we're getting to the point now where women are able to report, they have avenues to report, and this is where we are today.
What these women are saying, though, is that they reported and they got in trouble for reporting. There is no ability to report without feeling like there's now retaliation. And the thing specifically about the Seattle Police Department is that this claim comes after 10 women who recently spoke with KUOW alleging sexism and harassment within SPD. They had done those interviews, which again, SPD denied. This also comes after a 27-year veteran of the department filed a lawsuit against SPD and Chief Diaz alleging gender, wage, and job discrimination. And then another long-term officer, actually a detective, Denise Cookie Bolden, filed a lawsuit after 43 years with SPD. She filed a lawsuit alleging that she faced daily racism and gender discrimination. So we can say this is something that happens in many big organizations, and it happens and women are feeling like they can finally say something. I would say that within SPD, they need to address what kind of culture is it that these women are saying that when they did report it, that they're getting retaliated against or are no longer eligible for promotions.
I think you're right. And I think the most alarming thing about what you're talking about, Ursula, is this, is how you talked about at the very end. Basically, SPD is saying, we're going to find out that this is basically, it's not true. It's unfounded. What?
Okay.
Like, we need more than that. We're going to, hold on. At least, hey, you know what? We're aware of this. Let's go ahead and focus and try to get to the bottom of them. Don't come out and automatically just say that this will be found to be unfounded.
The fact that right now SPD has fewer than 500 active police officers. We're talking about a department that is at its lowest staffing level right now since the 1950s, and they are trying to recruit more women. I think that they have an extremely big issue that needs to be addressed. Are you okay, G? I want to. You suddenly got some allergies.
Weird.
I know.
Yeah, I don't know what happened. Yeah, it's weird. Thank you, Chef, for bringing over the Kleenex, man. I don't know what's going on. All right, go ahead.
Okay, so let's talk about it. I do know that you had a busy night because there was a big party that, I called you right in the middle of, and bless your heart for answering the phone. But big news. So a University of Texas defensive tackle,
Byron Murphy. This pick, so let me first set you guys up. So this draft was kind of like unheard of. What I mean by that is the first 10 picks saw six quarterbacks go. that's, and if you guys, you know, Michael Penix Jr., he went number 8 to the Atlanta Falcons. That's kind of unheard of. The first 10 picks also didn't have anybody on the defensive side of the ball, right? So I'm thinking, that's the number 10 pick, and then the Seahawks have the 16 pick. And I'm thinking, oh boy, so the Seahawks are going to really have their pick of the top picks. In the entire first round, Ursula, only one defensive tackle was taken in the first round. And it just so happened to be picked by the Seattle Seahawks, Byron Murphy. He's so good. And I'm not exaggerating. Now, I'll be honest. In the past, I've gotten on and I've reacted to the draft and I got on like, oh yeah, you know, this pick is going to be good. It's going to be great. It's almost like sometimes like going to see the baby and like you go, oh, you got to see so-and-so's baby. Like, yeah, oh, it's so cute. And sometimes you're just lying. Like, because not all babies are cute.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? This baby's cute. This Byron Murphy, this pick, no, I'm being very serious. He is so good. He's from DeSoto, Texas. He played DeSoto. It's the same place that Von Miller played. If you play high school football there, it's like the equivalent of someone saying, I played Garfield high school basketball here in Seattle. And he played at the University of Texas. This was a home run pick.
And what I love is that he said his favorite team was the Seahawks growing up.
Yeah, everybody. A lot of these kids' favorite teams were the Seahawks. The Legion of Boom era is that's what they love. People grew up on the Seattle Seahawks.
Think about that for a second, right? Because it doesn't seem that long ago for us. But for him, he was like 10 years old watching the Legion of Boom. And that's how far away we are from that. And I'm really excited to see guys who are inspired by that come into the building and maybe start a new tradition with Mike McDonald.
Yeah. Ursa, what was you doing last night? Why'd you call me?
I cannot share on the air.
Oh, okay.
But in any case, it sounded like it was my husband and my sons were like, this is a pick that no one's going to dispute. This was like the best they could do.
It was.
With what they could
do. It was,
okay.
No doubt.
Okay. Well, I unfortunately need to bring up a really sad story because you heard in Heather's newscast that our fentanyl crisis is really taking a toll in Everett, where 3 babies overdosed in just 4 days.
Everett first responders have answered 3 calls in the past week involving fentanyl overdoses in babies, and one of the children died. Everett Fire says the fatal overdose happened on Wednesday afternoon. They were called to an apartment on West Casino Road. They took the 13-month-old to the hospital, and that's where the child died. The other overdoses happened last Saturday to an 11-month-old and to a 6-month-old late Wednesday morning. Both were revived with Narcan. Lisa Brooks, Cairo News Radio.
And it just raises the question, when you're in the middle of a fentanyl crisis like we are, and basically the entire country is, so many families dealing with addiction, how do you keep something like this from happening other than the obvious one? But you've got forces working against each other because there's this push to keep families together. A law that went into effect last year makes it more difficult for the state to remove a child from a home, specifically if the parents are addicted to drugs. And the law says that the kid needs to be at risk of imminent physical harm before caseworkers can even get involved. But then you see cases like this.
Ursula, the way you just explained that to everyone, you were spot on. And what I mean by that is I didn't know that you were going to bring that angle. That was the angle that I was going to talk about. As you know, that I'm fresh off doing events centered around foster care, right? And how in the past, it was families were split up because they would come in and just take the kids real fast, right? And they have slowed up on that, which good they have, because they want to like, hey, let's go through a process to figure things out. This right here is a little slip in the crack. The fentanyl crisis makes things a lot difficult. So the question would be, what do you do? Well, I'm going to say this, Ursula. This right here is one that you got to have a hard line in the sand. If you are a family and you're a parent and fentanyl, and that's present at the same time, child, you got to take the kids.
Agree.
You got to take the kids.
Agree. For the safety of the kids, not to punish the parents, but until you can get treatment, until you can get clean, your kid is not safe.
Right.
And this goal of trying to keep the families together and reduce racial injustice in the welfare system, that's a great goal. But ultimately, your primary concern is keeping the kids safe. And we're every month, it seems that we get more and more of these types of stories.
Right, right.
And to see three in one city within 1 week.
Mm-hmm. We got a problem.
It is.
We got a problem. And more of these stories, I hope they don't happen. But if they do, this is going to have to be all hands on deck. This is a real emergency.
There is some debate within the social services community about removing kids. And the argument is usually that when you keep the family together, there's a greater chance of the parents actually completing treatment, etc. But I agree with you. You got to take the kids away. But there is also a move in Washington State. Once you get someone into incarceration or into treatment, to allow them to have the women to have their infants with them at that time. So as long as they're receiving care, they can have their children with them, which I fully support.
I would totally be okay with that as well. Again, putting the safety of the infant at the forefront.
Yep.
Absolutely. Okay, we have one last thing, and you know what it is. It's all about graffiti. And I just want to tell you that the Lynnwood Police Department has come up with a great idea. They're launching a community graffiti cleanup program to combat this never-ending problem.
Repeatedly vandalized over and over and over again. People's personal fences along their properties are being vandalized and graffitied over and over and over again, and it gets super tiring for them.
That is Marin McKay with the Lynnwood Police Department. She tells Fox 13 that you can get your supplies.
Lowe's is offering a complete graffiti cleanup kit. So there's two options. There's a $25 option and a $40 option. The $40 obviously is if you have a bigger space that you need to clean up, you need more paint and things like that.
And once you get your cleanup kit, she says you can stop by the police station. Your expenses will be reimbursed with a gift card. You know that I just love to give props to anyone trying to do something with our ever-growing graffiti problem.
This question is for everyone, because we talk about graffiti a lot. Is it getting better, or are things getting worse when it comes to graffiti? That's a very serious question. I'll give my opinion first. I think it's getting worse.
I do too.
I think
it's just where I drive and where I see it. But if driving along I-5, I think it is worse.
I think it's getting worse.
I have graffiti like a block from my house on people's fences. People do it on graffiti. These kids graffiti trees in my area. Freaking trees.
When I was visiting Beautiful Swim, I'm out there at a park and there's graffiti on one of the restrooms. I'm thinking, oh man, looking at the beautiful scenery and then graffiti. Even happens in small towns, by the way.
No. Interesting. I just feel like we're going to keep talking about this. 10 years from now, they're going to still be talking about, like, how come they didn't do anything about this problem?
Ban spray paint.
Yeah. We have Ursula talking about it. Why didn't they listen to Ursula? Hey, coming up next, we have a guest here on the show. We're going to be bringing on the mayor from Burien. And of course, we're going to be talking about the city's ongoing homelessness issue and the law enforcement and the enforcement conflict with King County Sheriff's Department. So we'll do all that next, Jen Ursula.
Welcome back to the Gian Ursula Show. It is a fresh Friday. Thank you so much for joining us this morning. Burien continues to battle against homeless encampments without the help of the King County Sheriff's Office. Sheriff Patty Cole Tyndall believes Burien's new homeless ban is unconstitutional, and she's filed a lawsuit in federal court to help sort that out. Meanwhile, Burien is suing the Sheriff's Office for refusing to enforce a city ordinance. Our show is all about trying to find solutions. We invited both sides to join us. The sheriff is withholding comment because of the legal action, but Burien Mayor Kevin Schilling joins us live on the Gian Ursula Show. Good morning, Mayor.
Good morning, and thanks so much for having me on. I've been a listener for a while, and I really appreciate how you guys try to get to the crux of where people are at, find common ground, and show people that it's okay to disagree sometimes and that it doesn't need to be personal.
Exactly. Thank you, Mayor. Well, you held a news conference yesterday, and immediately afterward, the sheriff and the county executive released a statement saying essentially that they had no issue enforcing the old law. I'll read a quote, and then I want you to respond. Mayor Schilling claimed that there's no need to reinstate the prior ordinance because it already exists, but it was replaced and amended with the adoption of the new one. This leaves the sheriff's office with nothing to enforce except the new ordinance, which, again, appears unconstitutional on its face. What is your response?
Well, it's funny that you have that statement. I did not receive a copy of that statement. I didn't even know they put it out. And as far as I know, it's the first time that the county executive and the county sheriff are now issuing statements together, which clearly shows that this is the direct result of voters not being able to vote for a sheriff anymore. I will say that I think their statement is interesting because at the press conference yesterday, all we did was ask that they come to the table, and we're ready and willing and open to sit down, and we've asked them to sit down, and they're responding by saying no. I will say that also, too, in their statement, it sounds like they're not understanding the process of lawmaking in cities where nothing is replaced. It's just amended. We didn't replace an ordinance. We amended it. So everything still exists. They could enforce any part of it tomorrow that they wanted to. But instead, we're going into the media and talking about this stuff in the media instead of getting each other at the table, which is the actual process of figuring this out through our oversight committee and now, I guess, through the courts. So it's unfortunate that they're continuing to do this. And as I've said, I'm ready and willing to sit down with them, and so is the city staff, but they've not said they'll do that.
You know, Mayor, you beat me to it. I was going to say something about that. And I don't know if you've heard me talk about what's going on with Burien and the homelessness crisis and all this stuff and the encampments and who's enforcing what. And well, you know what I say about you guys? I say, you know what? The city of Burien doesn't seem like they care. It doesn't seem like they want to get to the bottom of it because there's constantly this back and forth. And so I've said that, and it feels good to actually hear you say that you want to come at get to the table. And I want to ask this, because 6 months ago, you guys accepted a $1 million from King County to build the tiny homes village and also to kind of help with the housing of those that are unhoused in Burien. I have an opinion sometimes that I don't think that Burien has been doing a good job. I want you to tell me why I'm wrong.
Well, thanks for that lead up, I guess. I'll happily take you up on that. I think one of the reasons why that perception is wrong is because, number one, we're a resource-strapped city. We're 52,000 people. We have a small budget. We don't have major economic drivers the way our neighbors do, like SeaTac and Tukwila, that have over $150 million budgets. Our budget is $32 million. We're resource-strapped. We're trying to increase the resources we have, but within that resource-strapped capability, we have just allocated $2.9 million to our Human Services Fund, specifically to homelessness prevention and homelessness outreach and services. We've just allocated that. We have a 95-unit permanent supportive housing complex coming online in May. That is something that we've been working on over the last couple of years, and we were the first city to implement a local placement requirement for 30% of those rooms to be for people who are locally placed. We just fast-tracked the permitting process for a 95-unit permanent supportive housing building with Mary's Place and Mercy Housing, as well as an increase of 200 shelter beds for their facility. We have a new RFP going out for hundreds of thousands of dollars for service outreach. We are working in collaboration with our regional cities within SCIP to allocate money to other projects in the region.
Mayor. This sounds fantastic, and I just want to ask, is some of that shelter space for men? Because that was one of the issues.
Well,
this is
the problem, and I'll address that because, you know, I read your article about it, Ursula, when you posted it a couple weeks ago, and you specifically talked about men's shelter. But here's the deal. Cities aren't the ones that are operating these shelters. Nonprofits and non-governmental organizations have to operate these shelters. We have passed a a councilmatic action to allow for permits for shelter and expedite them and waive fees to open them. Unfortunately, and we've literally personally called and asked every single church and nonprofit in the city of Burien, unfortunately, nobody has wanted to open up a shelter. And we can't force anybody to do that. So until we have willing nonprofit and non-governmental organizations that are willing to partner to do that, we can't force anybody to.
But in the meantime, Mayor, I do want to point out that the latest camping ordinance in Burien and bans homeless people from sleeping within 500 feet from buildings, including schools, libraries, parks, and other city facilities, which essentially leaves very few spots available. And I think that is the issue that I was hoping that you could address, because the sheriff's office and the county are saying it's the issue of this latest ordinance, which essentially leaves no place for them to stay. Yet there is no shelter available specifically for men.
Well, I will say that is only enforced in accordance with Martin versus Boise. That is only enforced if there's no shelter space available. So there's no enforcement of it and saying to somebody you cannot sleep there if there's no shelter space available. And this is not anything different than what the city of SeaTac does. In fact, the city of SeaTac, they contract with the sheriff's office, and the sheriff's office enforces their camping ordinance and camping regulation, and they institute $1,000 fines to people who have to be enforced. So we don't do that. We don't have fines. We don't have arrests in our enforcement of the ordinance. SeaTac does, and King County Sheriff enforces their ordinance just fine. So ours is in accordance with Martin versus Boise because we don't enforce it if there's no shelter space available. Mm-hmm. That's the key there.
Well, I want to make sure I got this right. So if I'm a man and I am sleep somewhere, an encampment there in Burien. Right now, today, because I know you talked about needing a nonprofit to come there and partner with them. Right now, today, can you tell us what you have available for men if they were to come up and say, hey, sir, excuse me, G, you cannot sleep here. How much space do you have for men to sleep?
Well, gee, you're getting to the crux of it. We don't have a men's shelter, but a lot of cities don't. Most cities don't have specific shelters across the board that fit every single need. And so that's what I'm saying. We need folks to partner and work with us to open them. We're open to it. The council literally passed expedited permits and no fees associated with opening up a shelter. So we haven't had people step up to do that. And that's, you're getting to the crux of the problem. There's not enough shelter space, transitional housing space available around the region, but that's not necessarily just a Burien problem. That's a King County Regional Homelessness Authority problem.
Right. And so you're right. And when we're talking about Burien, when we do have this discussion, because, you know, you guys come to, you're in the news a lot. When we talk about you guys, that's what Ursula and I talk about all the time, is that you guys don't have the space to facilitate for the men that are sleeping out there. And so it's like a round and round. It's the same thing. But I, again, appreciate you, the mayor, coming on to talk about this. I just hope going further that you guys can sit down and talk about this.
Well, it sounds like, Mayor, so right now we want to help facilitate whatever it is. So you are inviting the sheriff and the King County executive to sit at a table and work this out.
Without
in the
cameras.
Meantime, what is happening? What is happening in terms of homeless encampments in Burien?
Well, they're growing. You know, we've seen a growth in tent camping on the street. We've seen a growth in overdoses. We've seen a growth in businesses having to respond to property damage and violence in the camps at night. So we're seeing issues that are permeating from unregulated and illegal tent encampments. But as I said, I'm willing, and the city manager and the city attorney are willing to sit down with the sheriff and the executive. We have asked them to. They're not interested in doing that, apparently.
City of Burien paying the King County Sheriff's Office for their police services right now?
Yes, we are. We are. The only part that we're not paying them for is the part that they're not enforcing, which is the ordinance they're not enforcing.
So we're
not paying for that element of it because they're not doing their job. And so the thing is, we're trying to sit down in the oversight committee process, which is the actual legal process in place to deal with these issues. And that's what we're trying to make it go through. That's what the sheriff should have done in the first place, shouldn't have sued us. And I'll just say this, too. They are not enforcing the ordinance claiming it's unconstitutional, although they've changed their language a little bit. bit in this new statement you read me, but they're claiming it's unconstitutional without an actual judge saying it is. And just on Monday, we heard oral arguments at the U.S. Supreme Court around the appeal of Martin versus Boise and around the constitutional question of the Eighth Amendment and if some of these regulations violate cruel and unusual punishment. But the Deputy Solicitor General to Joe Biden for the president, for the federal government, said and argued at the U.S. Supreme Court, it is common sense and practical to allow cities to have time, manner, and place restrictions on public camping. So that's the argument the federal government's making. That's the argument we're making. And it's unfortunate that the county and the sheriff aren't enforcing our laws until a judge has actually made that decision.
Burien Mayor Kevin Schilling, we sure appreciate you joining us.
Thank you. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Coming up next here on the GNR Show, we need to talk about how this is a first. A Maryland athletic director got a principal or try to get a principal fired. Wait till you see the tactics. We'll do that next, Gino. It is the Gene Ursa Show. Good morning, everybody. We need to talk. I just feel uncomfortable talking about this segment. Can you trust what you hear anymore? I want you guys to buckle up for a wild story involving allegations of racism. And imagine this happening to you. Baltimore County Police believe a local athletic director by the name of Dazen Darien is behind an AI-generated racist voice recording of the principal of the school that he worked at. We get this more from WUBS9.
Police say the former Pikesville High School athletic director created the audio recording as retaliation against the school's principal when his contract was not renewed. The recording impersonated the principal's voice, and it included racist and anti-Semitic insults about students. Charging documents state that the audio clip was originally sent to a friend group of three teachers, including Darien. Now, one of those educators admitted to police she sent the clip to a news outlet and a student because she knew that student would spread that clip around. Darien originally denied any involvement, but police have now connected the email address that sent that audio clip to his grandmother's house out in L.A. with a recovery phone number being Darien's own cell phone.
As you can imagine, this has been a very difficult time for Pikesville High School community, Principal Eisworth and his family, and Team BCPS.
Baltimore County Police say that the former athletic director was taken into custody yesterday morning at BWI Marshall Airport as he was attempting to board a flight. Now, Baltimore County State's Attorney Scott Schellenberger said that the case appears to be one of the first of its kind nationwide. He said the Maryland General Assembly may need to update state laws to catch up with the nefarious possibilities of this new AI technology.
Did you hear the last part, everybody? They might need to update state laws. This is the first of its kind across the country. Ursula, you've been in news for 36 years, my friend. You tell us what you think.
Think of the existential threat that exists for whether it's in our industry, voice actors, et cetera. What I think is we're moving into very scary times when you can make anything sound exactly like that person. It sounds just like the way they emphasize words, the way they phrase sentences. I mean, you can make it sound exactly like that person. How easy is it going to be to make a fake of someone's voice and make them say things that are dangerous, mm-hmm. fireable?
Ursula, this principal would have lost, they would have lost their job and they would have been shunned probably for the rest of their life had it not been for the carelessness of this Dazen Darien sending it to on the West Coast with his email address and recovery. If it wasn't for that mistake, this principal is fired and shunned and is being blasted all over the news for this.
I mean, I love the idea of AI for so many things, but we really haven't looked enough at the dark side of AI. And other than we talk about images and we talk about, you know, whether it's with Taylor Swift or these fake deep AI images. Right. But now we're talking about voice fakes.
The Chat GPT founder last year stood before Congress and said, please, we need regulation. When he did that last year, that was my sign of, this is serious. So, anyway, scary times. Okay, Ursula, in the 10 o'clock hour, we got, like you always say, an action-packed full slate. At 10:30, Mike Salk is going to join us to talk about the Seahawks draft. And also, Mike Salk was a part of a race where he raced one of his producers. We'll talk about that as well. And then Kate Stone is going to join us to talk about and explain what happened to a woman who was sexually assaulted downtown Seattle. All that next. Gene Ursula.